you said that 25% of work are new roles and 50% is existing jobs that are upskilling. Take any field. Describe like what that means in context, and how does the office environment fit into upskill?
Let's just take, you know, a worker at Salesforce who maybe have been in marketing and realize that the nature of the way in which you reach the customer from a marketing perspective is more the pull than the push. And this, you know, employee was sort of skilled in the push, which means like I'm pushing out messages to you via digital channels versus working with an influencer network or working with collaborative companies who actually pull people into, you know, selling that product, right? And so this worker decides, you know what, I'm going to upskill and I'm going to figure out how to actually learn coding. And I'm going to learn how to essentially digitally code some of these aspects or algorithms that naturally find, you know, buyers through digital networks as opposed to me writing copy. I also think that people who, you know, do repetitious work and they're cranking out a product, they may be, you know, producing financial models, and it's a very easy job that they can do, you know, at home because someone just gives them the assumptions, they plug it in. If you're just planning to continually crank out your work, then I think that's problematic.
I had a friend of mine who is a commercial real estate broker in Chicago, and pre-COVID, I asked her what type of subleases are out there, what's available, and she told me that basically every law firm in Chicago recognized that they had way too much space. They had an office for everyone, and they're going to this model where an employee that came in could use any office. They could just kind of click and play. And Nicholas Bloom, who was on our show a few months ago, analyzed the future of work. He's a professor at Stanford. He imagined a world where, you know, the marketing team might come to the office on Monday and Wednesday, and the technology team might come to the office on Tuesday and Thursday, and on Friday, maybe we all get together to talk about firm-wide decisions.
And so there's a notion of if your organization is siloed and you're still in a hierarchical or traditional machine, you know, machine-based structure as opposed to an agile network structure, then it's perfectly logical that you would sort of set up, you know, the marketing team to show up one day and then, you know, each of the silos to show up a particular day. But if you're a networked or an agile organization, you're figuring out the teams, the collaborative teams, and those teams are developing charters for how they want to work and make decisions together. And you'll find that those companies are actually, you know, driving different solutions. You know, I was talking to a CEO one day who was really, you know, struggling with the talent that wants to work at home and some of the talent, the younger talent that wants to, you know, be in the office, because the younger talent has all felt like last year they've lost the advancement in their careers. And in fact, a side note to that is that, you know, over the last few months, we've been interviewing for analysts and senior associates. And when asked why are they leaving their current job, the number one reason why they are saying they're leaving their job is because their manager is not coming into the office. They feel that they're going to miss this opportunity for learning. Another technology company I was talking to in Seattle, going to go with that hoteling model that you sort of mentioned, that everybody would sort of be able to check out a desk when they arrived. And there was an insane revolt that happened within the organization, largely because there's this logical thing that happens when you give somebody space in an office, they feel a part of the organization.
I remember in 2008 when the crisis hit, I spoke to some buddies of mine who worked at like a Canadian bank in New York City, and they always assumed they were going to grow, and so they had like an extra floor just in case for growth. And when everyone said, oh, my God, not only do we not need that extra floor, but we have an extra floor to go, it put an enormous pressure on office rents. You know, this is a very, you know, vertical supply curve that where price is going to collapse if an enormous percentage of the market becomes available. What do you think the needs for office space will be? Will it be, you know, down 10, down 20, down 30%? And will that have an incredibly dramatic negative impact on real estate? Jane Jacobs talk about, you know, what's the implications for B-minus, mm-hmm. C-plus office, is that it needs to be mm-hmm. transitioned into residential. Do you see a tremendous excess of office space and that office space will be transitioned towards residential and in dense urban areas? How do you think about the whole picture?
No, this is a phenomenal question. And it really comes down to supply-constrained markets and supply-constrained markets that have demand drivers and non-supply-constrained markets that don't have demand drivers. And let me give an example of, you know, what's really going to happen here is that we have the bifurcation of two kinds of products, right? The human loves new products. And so we have new construction, which is always desired and seems to be a panacea for talent attraction. And, you know, to get that, companies pay an enormous price to get new construction. And what I mean by an enormous price, they sign 10, 12-year leases. And I don't know what technology company knows how big they're going to be in 3 years, but certainly over 10 years, they're going to be wrong. And so typically, to your point, what happens is they plan 10% growth a year. They're signed a 10-year lease. They're doubling the size of space they need day one than what they need, you know, currently, right? So they'll get 2x the space. And this, as to your point, takes down a heck of a lot of space that, you know, may end up on the sublease market for a while, or if they have a good cash position, they just want to control it just in case. It is creating pressures. Then you have everything else. And if it's still your father's office building and it's going to, you know, be your father's office building, it's going to be a race to the bottom because the market and the customer is only going to be able to differentiate by price. And if there's a ton of supply in these non-supply constrained markets or in markets that have not don't have demand drivers, you know, that don't have really big demand drivers like D.C. or Chicago, I think we're seeing demand come back pretty strong in New York right now. But I think it's got a long road to go because there's a lot of product. But in markets like LA and markets like the Bay Area and markets like Seattle and Boston, there are constraints to supply. Things, you know, are defined to a particular area and they have very strong demand drivers. And so in those markets, I think you're going to find product will do just fine. In fact, it'll take a little bit of time to absorb some of the stuff, but, you know, I don't think you're going to have, you know, issues that you saw in Dallas where you know, some of the product is considered obsolete, you know. And obsolete means that it's been vacant for more than 3 years.
I don't know Dallas, but I'm familiar with New York City a little bit. And you mentioned new product, and the newest of the new product pre-COVID was Hudson Yards was coming online.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of excitement. People were planning to move out there. A number of my hedge fund buddies got some space in Hudson Yards, and they were totally psyched. And then, you know, when COVID hit, not only did Hudson Yards get in trouble, but all the retail and a bunch of the residential properties also really, you know, didn't do well. How do you think about the new as you think about Hudson Yards and the problems that it has?
What's interesting about new products and new markets is it creates an entirely new energy, even if it doesn't make any sense from a geographic perspective. You talk to any real estate person who understands the traditional dynamics in New York, and they're like, Hudson Yards, I just don't get it. And I got it just because it's new product. It's the shiny new object. I think how they do over time really depends on if there's infrastructure to support you know, a population to get, you know, relatively easy access to that. Fulton Market in Chicago, it was outside the loop. People were like, that's crazy. Like, there's no train that goes over there. Well, there's this thing called Uber, and there's really great food and beverage and amazing environments, and those buildings just keep getting built and built and built in a market that has pretty substantial vacancy. So I think you're going to see continued bifurcation of this market between new products that have high amenities, great ground floors and energies that really feel that you're a part of the community.
Fulton Market started as a food and beverage mecca.
Food and beverage.
Where did this come from? Yeah. Oh, my God, this place is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then office kind of went to the new food and beverage place. Is that a different way of thinking about it? This is not if you build it, they will come, but we built food and beverage, and then office said, oh, my God, we got to be next to that because that's where the fun is. Is that how
we're seeing? Well, yeah, and that's where talent wants to be. Talent wants to be near the cool stuff. And so if you can sort of highlight to people on your HR tour, look at all these cool restaurants and places you can be and you can hang out with your colleagues, people start to envision their lifestyle. Now, keep in mind, like work is a lifestyle now. It's not like a place that I clock in at 8 and clock out at 5. These are people that are part of my community, and so I want to know what's a part of my community. And so much so that this ground floor experience and environment is so much a part of how we curate office buildings now.
Brooklyn, mm-hmm. when I was a young man, Citi put out that tower in the middle of Brooklyn, and everyone said, my God, is anyone ever going to go out there? And now we have a whole host of young people living there with cool hotels, cool restaurants. But I haven't seen a lot of office being built in Brooklyn. Would you think that Brooklyn is going to become a new office mecca, or is it going to remain just primarily res and retail?
I mean, here's the interesting thing about office and the way in which companies pursue office space. Jobs follow people, right? People don't necessarily follow jobs unless it's like, you know, I've always wanted to work for Tesla and I go follow them to Austin, Texas. But for the most part, jobs are going to that location so they can capture that talent. If you think about Brooklyn, you know, and my access to talent, how do I get Brooklynites? I mean, downtown is the centroid for getting Brooklynites and also people in New Jersey and people further up Manhattan, right? And so I think that the challenge with putting office in Brooklyn is that it's not the centroid of talent, right? You can access Brooklyn talent by being in downtown, but you can't access talent elsewhere when you're in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's pretty limited to Brooklyn only because of the transportation
That's right.
Problem. Well, that was why it was kind of interesting what you mentioned with Fulton Market, which is not very transportation friendly. I mean, the metro station's not bad, but you know the rest of it isn't really designed to go that area. Oh, but what about Uber? Uber can solve that, but Uber can't solve a lot of things. I mean, we have you know what COVID did was traffic has been non-existent. Traffic's going to come back with a vengeance, and when it does, it's going to limit where work can be. So how do you think about the transportation nexus as being the critical variable for where you're going to build your new office buildings?
Yeah. No, it's a phenomenal point. You know, and going back to the Fulton Market example, I think the thing that really shifted in was the vote of confidence is when McDonald's moved their headquarters in from the suburbs into the Fulton Market neighborhood, right? Because they were deliberately going after, they couldn't hire young people. And as soon as they went into Fulton Market, they were able to hire a ton of young people who wanted to work in that market. And they you know, they realized that McDonald's was a different company because it had totally shifted from the suburbs and moved into the city. But I think your comment about transportation and access is really going to be key. So when I look at a market, let's say like Austin, which was the only market that actually had job growth during 2020, office employment growth in 2020, Austin that has had like unbelievable growth and has absolutely no infrastructure to support transit except the car. And this is going to be a really interesting experiment.
I feel like there's a ton of uncertainty. And you opened with what's so incredible about the new building is they're able to lock people down for 10-year leases. Do you think the long-term lease is a thing of the past, or is that something you can still persuade, or is the fear of the unknown sublease market and the unknown employment market for them, or the unknown future for them so high that they may not wish to enter term leases?
Yeah, exactly my point of the bifurcation of the market. You're only going to enter the long-term lease to essentially engage in new construction because the quantity of supply of new construction is so finite. And to get it, you're willing to commit huge resources and take a big, you know, swallow a big pill. And what's happening in the office industry is the lease has gotten shorter and shorter, and the retention rates have gotten smaller and smaller. In essence, the landlords have to do more to create a stickiness and a higher service level.
Pre-COVID, WeWorks was the phenomena. They took down a crazy amount of space in every market. They were the number one guy, and they offered a product to get rid of term, and in exchange, we're going to jam you in tighter than you ever thought was possible in an office environment, and not just with people who you work with, but strangers. Now, in a period of COVID, that seems insane.
I think the concept that was there was actually allowing sort of a much more flexible lease strategy. You know, I know, you know, a lot of sort of the WeWork practices were, you know, in essence, buying top line revenue to essentially obviously reach, you know, their revenue targets. And many of the things weren't sustainable. I mean, they sort of structured a lot of things that had duration matching issues between long-term leases and sort of buying really short-term deals. But I think the model in and of itself, a high service level model with a really good digital layer that gives, you know, companies a purview as to sort of usage. And so there are operators in this space who've really figured out the model, and they're in it for the long game.
You started the conversation by saying, look, it's about collaboration and getting pulled to work. And if Nicholas Bloom is right, where, you know, we need to meet at the office to talk about and collaborate about certain things on a very flexible schedule, is that Regis space where they can offer, you know, conference rooms and digital technology in a very easy way, is that just going to just dominate and allow for, you know, multiple firms to work in shared spaces? Is that our future?
Yeah. I think you're gonna see sort of the hotelification of the office market, right? They're gonna see a variety of different products that suit, you know, different needs. You know, a lot of people don't like the Regis model. They don't like the aesthetic. They don't like the vibe. So they'll go pursue, you know, a different hotel brand, right? One that they do like. And many owners are getting into the space and figuring out ways of which they can parse out the space and also, you know, provide a product to the market that the office, that the marketplace wants. But I do think what's interesting today is that the legacy way of building out space, the legacy way of procuring space, of hiring a broker, procuring your space a year from now, and it, you know, basically it takes you, you know, 6 months to build it out with all of the requirements that cities have and the construction processes, right? That most people, when they're out in the market and they need space, they realize they need it like today, and they can't wait a year to get it.
Went to a shared space in London pre-COVID, and I went to visit a friend of mine, and he was in some space, but it was weird. There was like no windows, and it was packed. I mean, it was very dense office. And, you know, we said, okay, we got to hang out. What are we going to do? I mean, so we went downstairs, and they were offering beer, and there was like a party going on in the office, which was kind of complicated. And I said, this is ridiculous. We can't work here either. Let's just go to a restaurant and order some food and talk. Is that really what young people want?
I like to think about, how did you learn? When I was in college, I had a laptop that lasted like about maybe 35 minutes, and then I had to find a plug and plug in, right? And so that really drove me to learn how to work in a dorm room. You know, and then the next generation really, you know, had mobile devices that lasted much longer, and they could work from a Starbucks, and they could work on top of rooftops, and they, you know, learned to work in cafes because it was sort of a unique space that they felt like they could be seen and seen. And so what happened is the whole generation of next workplace to attract the millennials looked like Starbucks cafes, right? Because that's how that workforce learned how to do projects and collaborate on assignments. And I think if you want to look at the future of work, look at how kids are learning today. You know, will that learning truly be decentralized and distributed? Will it be fully online content? Will kids truly learn that way? I think the reason why you're seeing all of these bars and cafes and things of that nature that are brought into fancy new workplaces is because they're attracting people from college to say, hey, look, this is just like college for you. It's like you never left.
I usually end our show with a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about in the office market?
I think what I'm optimistic about in the office market is that I think there's a whole new revolution of unique workspaces that truly allow humanity to thrive. What we're seeing is this integration of a lot of wellness aspects and a lot of concern of like making sure humans can perform and perform at their best level. And if that's bringing in natural light, if that's bringing in spaces that allow a little R&R, if it's like bringing in medical services or dental services so that there's this aspect of convenience, I think the workplace is not going to be about seeing the human as a machine, but actually seeing the human as a living organism that needs care, quite honestly. And then I think all of us can do our best work.
Dean Adler, when I asked him about the future of office, he mentioned getting access to fresh air. So he imagined that new construction would have balconies, would have the ability to engage with the outside. Do you see that? Is fresh air goes back to that wellness point you're making? that how do I...
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. If you think about it like humans as machines, we sort of put them in sort of assembly line or cubicles, right, in the Dilbert style. If we look at humans as things that need to, you know, have light and air to thrive, the tech companies actually have requirements. If you're building them a new building, they have to have a certain frequency of open windows or windows that can open. And these are even in high rises. Decks and rooftops and access to the outdoors become key leasing features. And we're looking at spaces across our portfolio that we can begin to open up, not just the ground plane, but other levels of the building, because these become really treasured amenities and really create differentiation in your product.